From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. There have been many political debates on the campuses of elite universities over the years. Often, students have effectively led movements that mirror off-campus struggles. One great example of that is how Black student movements historically used their positions within elite Ivy League schools to demand change. A new book about the Black student-led movements for civil rights and Black power tells that story. Its author is Stefan M. Bradley. He is an associate professor and chair in the Department of African American Studies at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. His earlier books include Harlem versus Columbia University, Black Student Power in the Late 1960s. He's the co-editor of Alpha Phi Alpha, A Legacy of Greatness, The Demands of Transcendence. And he now joins me to discuss his new book, Upending the Ivory Tower, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Ivy League. Welcome to the program, Stefan.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we often think of Ivy League schools as being these elite institutions that have made it very difficult for students of color to be part of them. And in recent decades, there have been huge debates around that. But during the civil rights movement, and even sort of before that, how open were these elite institutions to students of color, particularly Black students?
Yeah, before the civil rights movement, you saw very few Black students attending these Ivy League institutions. Before World War II, you can count on your hand the number of Black students who would be able to attend as undergraduates these institutions. Some institutions, one institution in particular, Princeton University, didn't allow Black students until World War II. So there were very few Black students who had the opportunity to attend, but those who did performed exceptionally well, but faced severe isolation. It was very difficult for them to move along and especially to socialize on campus. So they had to figure out ways to socialize amongst themselves, and that led to the creation of fraternities and various study groups and reading groups, things like that.
Was the struggle for acceptance within universities mirror of, or in how did it reflect the struggle around public education? We had the seminal Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision that formally ended segregation in public schools, K through 12 public schools. What bearing did that have on universities?
Well, you know, each of the Ivy League institutions is private, and so there was not a great deal of policy impact from decisions like Brown versus Board of Education, but there was influence from the civil rights movement. And so one of the things that you saw after the 1950s is many of these presidents of these institutions were influenced by what was happening in terms of the Black freedom struggle off campus. And everybody could see this on TV and this sort of thing. So even at the institution that I just mentioned, Princeton, the president of that institution said that we had been concentrating so hard on making life good for people abroad that we forgot that people need help here in the United States and that we have a long way to go in terms of freedom with regard to our domestic students. And so the idea is that the civil rights movement, the desegregation movement that was occurring off campus influenced leadership in these Ivy League institutions. So they took different steps than they had taken before. Some of that included admitting Black students in higher numbers, and they approached it in different ways. Sometimes they tried to go through foundations. Other times they tried to go through programs where they would send Black high school students to some of these day schools and preparatory schools in the Northeast in the hopes that they would build up their cultural understanding of the Ivy League institutions and then matriculate that way. But it took really until the the mid-1960s before you saw any major movement in terms of admission for Black students.
At what point did it become a point of pride within Ivy League institutions to have students of color, to have Black students in particular? I mean, these are institutions that, they're elite institutions. These are centers of white power. Every U.S. president has come from an Ivy League institution, and with the exception of Barack Obama, they were all white. So at some point, universities began to see the inclusion of and the numbers of the demographics, a nice diverse demographics within their student body as an asset. How did that happen?
Well, part of it has to do with the students themselves. When a few Black students got in and were able to establish an identity for themselves, by the mid-1960s, you saw a kind of a rise of a Black consciousness, and this idea that Black was indeed good enough, and that assimilation wasn't necessary, that Black students would push back. And so once we start to see, I think, some of the turmoil that existed in the mid to late 1960s with some of the uprisings that occurred around some of the nation's urban centers, you would see institutions working harder to admit Black students, particularly institutions that were in urban settings. So at your Penns and your Columbias and these kinds of places, you saw increased effort to admit Black students. After the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., many of these institutions really had the opportunity to reflect on where they were spatially, but where they were in terms of their representation of the nation. And students helped them along. Oftentimes, protesting students helped them with these reflections. And as a result, they started admitting more Black students. And in doing so, there was almost a competition between the institutions to recruit what they thought of as the top Black students in the nation. And so,
and we see the sort of struggle playing out even today on, say, the campus of Yale, etc. What about the avenue of sports within elite Ivy League institutions? Did these institutions see Black students as a way to make their sports teams more competitive? And if so, did Black students in turn use that as an entry point into these universities?
Absolutely, yes. And so the Ivy League gets its name from, you know, from athletics. It's athletics affiliation. And so early institutions like Cornell, there were, you know, Black people who played on the football teams. And at the other institutions, with the exception of, again, Princeton before, you know, World War II. But afterwards, Black players came to these institutions and thrived on the courts and on the fields and worked well for the institution. Now, in the book, I speak to the fact that sometimes these athletes got entree into the culture and into the institution in a way that students who didn't bounce a ball or catch a ball or chase a ball, in a way that they didn't get the same kind of treatment. And so this was, again, a form of a certain kind of privilege, that is the ability to show one's athletic prowess on the field or court. But institutions made good use of Black players, and in return, Black players made good use of the institutional status.
Let's talk about the role that Black students played on campuses during the civil rights movement specifically, and also the Black Power movement. Did you see a mirroring of the kinds of struggles that played out off campus, on campuses? I imagine that you didn't have the same dangers that civil rights activists did in facing police and their dogs and bullets. But of course, we also know that students did pay for these struggles with their lives, didn't they? And that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in particular was a very important part of the civil rights movement. That was a student movement.
Right, absolutely. And so students they took their cues from what they saw off campus, and you couldn't turn your head to what was happening in terms of the Black liberation movement off campus. And so students coming from these urban centers would see what was happening in their cities, see what was happening in the movement, and try to affect some kind of change on campus. Sometimes I argue out of a sense of obligation that they had this opportunity to attend an Ivy League institution, so they would prove, in a sense, their Blackness by being part of the movement and by creating access for other Black students. And
right,
so,
they had educational privilege.
Exactly. That educational privilege, in some ways, provided a sense of, among some students, not all students, but a sense of guilt that I must do something with all of this privilege I have. And so some of that might have been mirroring the methodologies and tactics of Black power groups off campus. And so mirroring the rhetoric of these groups off campus. And so you'll see students mimicking the language of the Panthers, or taking up the stances of the Revolutionary Action Movement, or other types of groups like that, in an effort to cajole, to pressure decision makers on campus to act in favor of Black freedom.
And in a way, those students also had the privilege of being in a space that, in theory, is supposed to value free expression, the free exchange of ideas, and I imagine that they took full advantage of that.
Absolutely, and you can imagine what kind of culture shock this was for the people that believed a Yale man was supposed to be like this, and a Harvard man was supposed to be like this and that. That was a culture shock for these people who claim to value democracy and freedom of speech in such a way. The students did take advantage of that in their efforts to protest, but also in their efforts to change the curricula in the Ivy League. And so by doing so, they were changing culture, which is more difficult than changing policy. So to allow Black students in is one thing, but to change the culture of these institutions once Black students are there is another matter, and it's a little bit more difficult.
So then do you see the demands and the struggles of Black students to have more Black faculty and to have Black studies departments as part of this political protest that they carried out on campus for civil rights?
Absolutely. So I think of this in terms of the larger decolonization effort that was occurring throughout the world in the non-Western countries of the world, where these nations were looking to cast off their European colonizers. So too were Black students in the Ivy League who looked to, as you spoke to earlier on, these were places where, well, I have no other way to put it, where white supremacy reigned in the curriculum, from the campus buildings, from the statues. So when Black students looked to bring Black studies onto campus, they were decolonizing knowledge in a way that it hadn't been done before. And so to me, yes, they were very much freedom fighters, and this was very much part of, I think, a larger Black freedom movement that occurred throughout the world. And so they saw themselves as Pan-Africanists, they saw themselves as nationalists, and they were trying to bring their institutions along. And so in addition, though, they also saw themselves as freedom fighters on behalf of Black people abroad. So in one case, students were demonstrating on behalf of the divestment movement, as people were trying to divest of their funds in Southern Africa, so students took up this struggle for Black freedom and brought it to campus.
Did they risk their positions? I mean, we talked about their educational privilege. We talked about them being able to take advantage of the culture of, you know, necessary culture of free expression and free exchange of ideas. But did Black students also pay a price for their activism, for their militancy?
Yes, and this is one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I tried to figure out why on earth would, you know, students who had this great privilege of attending Ivy League institutions, why would they risk all of that? The risk that they faced, we have to remember the Vietnam War was raging at this moment. And so young people their age were going off to fight in Southeast Asia. And if they got kicked out of school, which was totally possible for violating some of these policies with regard to demonstrations, if they got kicked out of school, they would open themselves up to the draft and potentially going off to put themselves in danger. That's one side of the whole thing. The other side of it is they risked a certain danger. Some of these students were first generation students. They risked a certain kind of status. They were bringing the dreams and hopes of their families to campus and their communities, and so they risked that as well. And this is the third thing that should be emphasized, maybe the most, is there's a certain amount of trauma that comes along with pushing against the institution that these back then young people still are feeling to this day. When they return to reunions and things like that, they talk about their feelings of you know, trauma that they faced during their time while there, and how liberating it was to push against the institutions. And so there certainly was a lot of risk involved with all of this, but they did it because they had a sense of collective identity, a sense of freedom for somebody other than themselves. And I think that's fascinating and worth noting.
So do you feel that the Obama presidency in part is a result of this sort of activism? You had Barack Obama, a young student at Harvard, his wife and first lady, Michelle Obama, who just has a new book out, a Princeton educated, brilliant student. You had these two African Americans in these incredibly elite Ivy League schools who perhaps owe their positions there to the incredible decades of work that Black students did to open up these institutions?
Clearly and unequivocally, yes. Yes, definitely. President Obama would not have been at Columbia University and later Harvard University. Michelle Robinson wouldn't have been able to attend Princeton University without the work of these Black students. Eric Holder, who came to Columbia the year after a major protest.
Nation's first Black attorney general, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. He arrived the year after that took place and in time to protest for a Black Studies Institute. As well as so many other people in the Obama cabinet. And so these people, they may not necessarily recognize it, but if it weren't for the activist campaigns and work of Black students in earlier decades, along with their white allies and accomplices, depending on how you look at it, they wouldn't have been able to achieve these heights and take advantage of these Ivy League institutions that produce America's leadership class.
So how do these struggles continue today? I briefly mentioned Yale. There are a number of institutions, not just Ivy League schools, but universities in general, where racial tensions spill over. You know, there's unfortunately white supremacy still reigns on many campuses. Do you see the struggle that Black students began on these campuses as continuing today? And if so, what are the struggles that they face today or that they've taken on today?
Yeah, good question. And so I think, yes, the struggle, there's a lineage, I believe. And so sometimes it goes quieter, sometimes it grows louder. After 2013, 2014, when you saw the shooting deaths of these young men and women, young Black men and women throughout the nation, students were able to see themselves as potentially victims of violence, in that way, state violence. And so students began demonstrating and rising up on campus. And so that allowed for students to once again begin thinking in terms of we, in terms of a collective identity. And that's helped because what they've done on these campuses is they're looking to shape culture, which I spoke about before. And so the ways that they're doing that is they're pushing against titles like master on Yale's campus, pushing against these images of slavery that you'll see on various campuses.
And there's many campuses with Confederate era statues as well.
Exactly, and pushing against the names of buildings with large slaveholding people, and so at Princeton you have now Toni Morrison Hall, and at Calhoun Hall was changed at Yale University, and so there are these changes occurring at Brown University. A new building is being named after an African American. These are cultural changes that take so long to move things along. But I think an enduring thing is these students are here again defending their Black Studies departments, here again calling for more Black faculty and staff and administrators. And the universities have to respond and have responded to these students. What these students are facing in terms of their experience is not too far off from what students faced in an earlier period. Surely not as severe, but that isolation that I spoke to, students still feel that, and they still try to work together to create a sense of identity and safety and support for themselves.
Do you feel that the Black-led struggle that is broadly termed Black Lives Matter is very much mirrored on campuses today in the way that the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Power Movement were mirrored on campuses during their times?
Yeah, I think this is, again, a good question. So here's the idea is these Ivy Walls can't keep social movements off campus. So when Black Lives Matter takes hold, it's going to be something that affects Black students on campus. And so Black students on campus will lift up oftentimes the platforms of the movement for Black Lives and take up even the chants, this is what democracy looks like, or the whole damn system is guilty as hell. These are the kinds of things that students take to heart and try to bring to their institutions in an effort to make their institutions more accessible to Black people. And so in terms of this relationship between Black people and the police, students on Ivy League campuses frequently talk about their interactions with campus police. They don't often turn out the same ways that some of these interactions with Black people on the street turn out with police officers, sometimes ending in fatalities. But this relationship is one that hits home for these students, even at Ivy League institutions today.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much, Stefan, for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for the work you're doing.
Stefan M. Bradley is an associate professor and chair in the Department of African American Studies at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. And we've been talking about his new book. It's called Upending the Ivory Tower, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Ivy League. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.